All right, thanks for joining me, everyone. Charles Moskowitz, welcome to the program, part of my ongoing series on history issues. We are joined by David T. Beato. He is the author of The New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights, The Untold Story of FDR's Concentration Camps, Censorship, and Mass Surveillance. Dr. Beato is he is a research fellow at the Independent Institute and professor emeritus at the University of Alabama. He received his PhD in history at the University of Wisconsin. He's the author of T.R.M. Howard, Doctor, Entrepreneur, and Civil Rights Pioneer, and From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State, Fraternal Societies and Social Services, 1890 to 1967, among other works. David, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with a quick thumbnail with regard to FDR, Franklin D. Roosevelt's administration, as the sort of not the originator, but certainly a catalyst for a move toward what we now have as obviously a surveillance state. You claim that he is really one of the architects that has led to the present situation. So let's give us a bit of an overview on that.
All right. Well, this Roosevelt is generally not associated with mass surveillance. And I think that that's partly because people are looking in the wrong places. They're looking at the FBI, for example, which during this period had, less than 200 phone taps on any given day. It had some unauthorized operations and so forth. But that doesn't really rise to the level of what we're familiar with today with mass surveillance. So what you need to look at is the role of a congressional committee that FDR was instrumental in creating. It was called the Black Committee. It was a U.S. Senate committee.
Mm-hmm. Hugo Black.
Hugo Black from my state, Alabama. Best known as a Supreme Court justice. However, at the time, he was best known as a populist, I guess you'd say, in a lot of ways, very loyal New Dealer, very ruthless, very effective point man for Roosevelt in the U.S. Senate, and very partisan. So again, these are all labels that we wouldn't really associate with him on the court, but definitely was the case in his political career. Okay, well, Roosevelt is elected in 1932. He takes office in 33, and he's, people are supportive of him. But by 1935 or so, there is rising opposition. And this is reflected by elections. For example, the Republicans take control of the New York State Assembly. They win a lot of what you would call by-elections. Roosevelt has fallen in the polls. And again, these are credible polls, right? In fact, in 36, he is shown as losing in very credible polls. And this is believed by the administration that he's in trouble, or potentially that it could be a competitive race. Of course, it ended up being a landslide, but they didn't really know that was going to happen because things had changed. So basically, this concern leads to a view that, look, there's this criticism of the New Deal. There is a rising criticism of Roosevelt. We need to get a handle on this. And they start to open investigations with the hope of perhaps discrediting this opposition. And the idea they come up with in the administration is, well, let's investigate these groups, these anti-New Deal groups, as lobbies, because that's kind of a bad word, and so forth. So let's look at them as lobbies. So they set up a committee in the U.S. Senate. Again, the administration orchestrated this, and they orchestrated the appointment of the first chair of that committee, Senator Hugo Black, because he was regarded as very loyal to the New Deal. So Black begins the investigation of anti-New Deal organizations, and he has a very broad mandate because they say indirect or direct lobbying. So what would indirect lobbying be? Be what we're doing right now. Anything that could have an impact on ideas, on the political climate. So it's just about anything. So he calls in, Black calls in witnesses, and it doesn't always go well because a lot of these witnesses push back, compare them to the Soviet secret police, and, it's not as effective. So
not a good look.
With the idea, What if we got a hold of their private telegrams and we could, you know, bring them in and then we'd have that information in front of us? Well, that's not easy, but there was a law. And this law required the telegraph companies, the big one, of course, was Western Union, but all of them had to keep copies of all telegrams. And these had been used for subpoena purposes in the past. If you had a specific case, you know, like any other communication, you had to name the specific person and what you were searching for and all of that. Mm-hmm. But they went to Western Union. They tried to do end run around that. And the Black said, here's one thing he wanted. He said, I want all access to all private telegrams sent to and from every single member of Congress for an entire 9-month period. Okay. Western Union says, well, do you have a subpoena? No, there's no subpoena. We just want it. So they basically didn't go along with it. Well, then basically Western Union, Black went to the FCC. And again, the administration is very much involved in this. And the FCC orders Western Union to comply. They could have fought it at that point, but they just said, all right. And they let him in. And so Black and his staffers came in. They start the search, like I said, looking at telegram communications between every single member of Congress flowing in and out of Washington. And they go through these. They go through thousands a day of the copies of the telegrams. And they are instructed by Black staffers, well, if you see anything like private between husband and wife, skirt past that and look for anything having to do with lobbying. Of course, that would have been
anything. Could I just ask, was this something that was known or was it done in secret? I mean, I can't imagine Congress going along with this, not to mention the American people.
It is not known initially. Okay. And but it just to sort of say they do thousands a day and it ends up to millions. They look at millions of these because if you do the math, that's the way it works. They start expanding the search to include other people. And here's how it became known. It is not publicized. But Western Union eventually comes to the conclusion that this is getting a little out of control, and they want it publicized. They want it fought. And so they eventually, when it starts to spread, and they're doing specific requests to go after this person and that person, Western Union starts to let them know, your telegrams are being searched. One of the people they let know is a guy named Newton Baker, who'd been Secretary of War under Wilson. Baker's kind of an easygoing, moderate kind of guy, right? Not a flamethrower. He is so mad when he finds this out that he says, if I saw a lynching of Senator Hugo Black, I would not join in the lynching. However, when they put the rope around his neck, I would not stop the lynchers. So he's pretty mad. Another guy that's really mad and has an effect is a guy named Silas Strawn, a leading Chicago law firm still bears his name. Winston and Strawn, I think. It's been in the news. But Strawn is big guy in the sense of powerful. He is the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, head of the Bar Association, and head of the American Golf Association. He brings suit that this is violating the Fourth Amendment, and he wins. He wins. There are other suits brought, and Black eventually just says, because they don't have the power to order him to return the telegrams, they say, we have limited power with regard to Congress, but we're going to step in and say you can't do this anymore. Black says, well, we've completed our investigations. You know, we had millions of telegrams. And it's a precedent. It's a precedent for future.
Oh, yeah. And they didn't return the information either, did they?
Oh, no.
I mean,
no.
So they had that in-house and they could go through sift through all the dirt which they're trying to get on people to blackmail them, basically.
Yeah, there are thousands of copies made. You can go and find them at the Library of Congress or U.S. Archives.
Incredible. And obviously that's information that could be used politically. And I mean, this is what they did to Trump, right? The FISA courts were spying on him and bugging the Trump Tower. And, you know, they had surveillance. But the problem with that one is that they had to go before a judge to make the case for that. And that's when they brought in that phony dossier and they you know, but the point I'm making here is, and Nixon with the bugging of the Watergate Hotel, you know, this is something that apparently under Roosevelt was done at a massive scale by the Senate. And it was just unprecedented in terms of the level of surveillance.
It wasn't, but it backfired. And this is what's the difference with today. There were a lot of people on the left, a lot of New Dealers who didn't like this. And one example of this was the great newspaper baron Black released a telegram from William Randolph Hearst to one of his editors, which was kind of like, you know, this guy's a communist. And it was sort of an over-the-top telegram. And what Black thought is this would hurt the opposition. But what ended up happening is a lot of key New Dealers, like a guy named Emanuel Seller, who I remember from my youth, still around, I thought was a hack. He just said, this is Mussolini tactics here. They went after the administration, and they would say things like, Black, who is a lot like Trump in many, Hearst, who is a lot like Trump in many ways, he's like an American like everybody else. He has the same rights as everybody else. So that's the difference with today, is that you have a lot of people on the left who push back against this stuff. A lot of people in the ACLU, a lot of leading liberal papers.
Back then, not so much today. I think that
then,
was true.
Yes.
Yeah, now they don't. Now they've taken 180 degree, mainly because they hate Trump, and it's like this deranged idea that anything goes if it's to stop Trump, including sending out these phony stories and then retracting them 2 days later after the damage was done.
Exactly. And people were able to rise above that. I mean, Hearst was despised by a lot of people on the left.
Right.
But they said, look, he's an American citizen, and this is bad what he's done. His private telegrams, for God's sake. And Black is releasing them to the public as a political ploy to win support for the committee, to make Hearst look bad. And this is just, there's a reaction against this. Yeah.
So, and once the reaction took place and the whole operation was ended, as you say, it set a precedent, and FDR and his people, I assume that the Black Committee forwarded it to them. They then had political fodder to use against their opponents.
They did, but it was a valuable precedent in another respect, because the court had ruled that this was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. By the way, they're using the term right of privacy all the time, critics of the Roosevelt administration. But they said this is violating the Fourth Amendment, and it could, future congressional committees could not do this kind of thing to the same extent because of this. And so when you look at later investigations, they don't have this power. So it does a positive impact in terms of the law.
But you definitely link the Black Committee doing this surveillance to the FDR administration. Is that right?
Yes, FDR recruits the committee. And I've got reason to believe that some of these telegrams actually ended up, you know, in FDR's hands. They were involved in this. And FDR was confronted about one of his key advisors, Raymond Moley, who didn't like this stuff. Moley was a key guy, been in the New Deal brain trust. He says, I don't like this. This is Black's going out of control. And Roosevelt just said, well, you know, you got to do this sometimes. You got to use these methods. And so Moley was shocked by this. It was key to explaining why Moley finally broke with FDR, because of conversations he had like this. He said the conversation went on for hours. And FDR was like defending Black. Like, what? But FDR had deniability in the case of the Black Committee, though. He created it, but there was some distance that he had what you could call plausible deniability.
Right. And again, we're not talking here about the FBI selectively going after certain people who had been identified as enemies, you know, like the mob or like the Ku Klux Klan or the Communist Party. We're talking here about just an overall wholesale spying operation on everyone in a particular area, in this case, Congress.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people were outraged because they hadn't done anything. They said, why are my private telegrams like Newton Baker? What have I done? What are you accusing me of?
Yeah. You know, well, that's the old thing. You have nothing to worry about if you didn't do it, right?
Yeah, Exactly.
Now, FDR, I think it's not a well-known element of his administration, but when he became president, he declared a state of emergency within a few weeks, and that was the powers that he, and it was ratified by Congress. He called for it in his inaugural address. This is very open. And he used that power to, for the what so-called bank holiday, shutting down all the banks so that they could then be stabilized or for whatever reason, and then some of them weren't allowed to reopen. But I think it was those emergency powers that have never been rescinded from the executive branch, and they continue to this day. I mean, I think it gives the executive branch certain functions that supersede the Constitution. I mean, the whole, you know, alphabet agencies, some of them went way overboard, especially the ERA. And that had to do with this emergency power by which they were set up under the executive branch. Do you think that played any role in this?
I don't know specifically. Certainly, he did have vast emergency powers. In fact, if you look at his 1933 inaugural address, everyone quotes the part of "all we have to, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself." That actually was not the big news story. The big news story where he says, "I want vast executive powers. I want Congress to give them to me," and it was sort of a threat. And it's at the end of that speech. In that, if you look at the newsreels of the time, the newsreels don't pick up on the fear section, they pick up on that. So the only surviving newsreels are those that highlight that part, because people went, my God.
Oh yeah, right. They pull out that quote. But he did get those emergency powers. And technically, I mean, I've heard some people who are theorists on this. Technically, it was a declaration of war. It was war powers. And it was a declaration.
Of World War One powers, like the Trading with the Enemy Act and that kind of thing.
That's right. I mean,
they're building on this precedent. Yeah,
it brought that back. I mean, just a little historic on that. I mean, Wilson during World War One was able to literally suspend portions of the Constitution. I mean, there were people put in prison for speech, including Eugene Debs, who was the head of the Socialist Party, and convicted in these sort of trials where there was no witnesses and it was very authoritarian in nature. All done under the guise of a national emergency under war. Those were mostly rescinded. I think they probably all were rescinded at the end of the war by Harding, who then pardoned Debs and sort of put that aside. But Roosevelt wanted to bring that back, I think, under the guise of dealing with the Depression. And I've heard it suggested that power has continued ever since. I mean, every 2 years when the new Congress sits, they renew it, even if it's just a little tiny piece of language in something. And that it's the basis for this massive government expansion overall, but specifically for the surveillance state. It was used by FDR to intern Japanese Americans before the war. And we're not talking here about spies. I mean, the FBI knew who they were. They did detain them immediately. We're talking about everyone, the entire population with Japanese ancestry.
Well, you know, if you look at that executive order that Roosevelt interned the Japanese, you know the word missing from it? Japanese. Uses terminology like persons who must be removed and other persons. It's a little bit like the references to slavery in the Constitution. They don't say slave. It's sort of like that. And when this came to Congress, because they had to fund it, Senator Taft said, basically, this is the worst piece of thing I've ever seen, because the legislation was the same way. Now, when it gets specific is when the military starts the actual operations of internment and evacuation. Then they say everyone of Japanese ancestry. But again, it's a still deniability. And I've never gotten a good explanation as to why Roosevelt's executive order, which was clearly intended to intern the Japanese, did not use the term Japanese once. And it fits in with this deniability. He can blame other people.
Plausible deniability. It's a I mean, the other example under FDR was that the convening of the Evian Conference in 1938, which was brought actually by Salar, Congressman Salar, among others, to address the problem of Jewish refugees trying to get out of Nazi Germany. And it was headed up by an American, a businessman by the name of, I think it was Campbell. And there were delegations from countries all over the world. And it was to address this question, can we help resettle these people as refugees in maybe Latin America, Canada? The conference didn't use the word Jew. It just simply talked about a vague reference to refugees. And it decided that it would not allow any of them out. It's one of these little chapters of American history that brings up the question that you're bringing up now with regard to the Japanese, which is why? Nobody knows why. But it's a classic example of this kind of bureaucratic legalese that's sometimes used to create a level of deniability for the government.
But when they did the specific enforcement, they had to get specific. And very specific. So when the military is doing its orders, it says everyone of Japanese ancestry, and we have to realize what that included. If you lived in the designated area and you were an orphan in an American orphanage of Japanese ancestry, you had to go to the camps. That's how specific that was. So it's very different than the Italian or the German internments, which, you know, I think there are plenty of problems with those. But you know, we didn't have Joe DiMaggio's family or Frank.
No, and they weren't interning the entire families. I mean, they were taking in maybe a handful of people who might have been problematic in a wartime, but it wasn't. And they knew those same people of Japanese ancestry, too. And that would have been, I mean, they could have defended that. But it wasn't like an entire internment of an entire ethnic group.
No, which this of course is on a different scale. And if you look at early polls that were taken, then as Americans were generally satisfied with the policy from December 7th until February, which was basically treated the Japanese more or less similarly to the Germans and Italians. There was no great rising demand to put the Japanese in internment camps that FDR was responding to. That is a myth that is perpetuated by history textbooks. They'll quote polls, but the polls were done after it was a fait accompli.
Also after they had launched a propaganda campaign of demonization, which dehumanized Japanese people. I mean, even a lot of people were involved in that. I think Disney was involved in it. You know, there's this massive national kind of denouncement of the Japanese people. And, you know, we've seen that happen somewhat recently in certain situations. I don't want to get into this too much, but I would argue that this happened against people who didn't accept the jab, right? Yeah. There was talk about internment camps. There was, they're killing people, and that kind of ridiculous demonization.
They were doing it in Australia, basically.
Oh, they actually set up camps in Australia.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a kind of power that has expanded, and I think that I don't have the details on this, but I understand that President Barack Obama signed legislation that actually makes it legal and official for the government to engage in propaganda. And again, I don't have the details. I should do a deeper dive.
Well, you know, when I started writing this book, which was 15 years ago, I couldn't have imagined how many modern parallels would appear in such stark form. And one of them was this whole issue of fake news, right? And the government, you know, FDR was very much at home with that theory that the newspapers that were criticizing, when we're talking about the top metropolitan newspapers, because this was a time when the print press was against FDR.
Right.
And he was accusing them of fake news and misinformation and all of that. And he was saying to reporters things like, I know you guys are told what to write. I love all you reporters, but I know they tell you what to write. You know, it was this conspiratorial stuff. But you see things like that. You see things like the Twitter files. You see all these perils. Sedition trials. I thought that was gone when I started writing my book. Sedition trials? That went out with the 1950s. Now they've come back with a passion.
It's highly politically motivated, and this is one of those things where the left has gone a volta faccia. It's the other shoe on the foot. You don't hear them talk about this. I don't know if it's Trump derangement or what, but you know, there's this. They don't criticize the FBI now. You know, it's sort of like back then. I mean, during COINTELPRO, they did criticize it, and looking back, they might have had a point. But now it's nothing. There's nothing said. Maybe we've become so conditioned to it. I don't know, but it's we're right now, I think, in this country, really at a very dangerous place.
Well, you know, it's interesting how things change with fashions. Political fashions. During World War II, the big advocates of sedition trials were the Communist Party. And many people on the left wanted to prosecute critics of the administration for sedition over and over again. And guess what? Only a couple years after that all petered out, they are being prosecuted. And then they suddenly start, many of them, belatedly making pro-civil liberties arguments. So that's what you see as a common pattern in American history, where people just, they suddenly discover civil liberties when they're under threat. It's sad. And that's why I find some encouragement in this period, because I do find people that are pretty consistent on both the left and the right over time. And mm-hmm. we need more people like that now.
Especially now, because of the censorship that's happened in big tech and the attack, I think, on Elon Musk, which I don't endorse many of his things. I mean, but the only reason why he's under attack is because he wanted to free Twitter. And even there, I'm not sure he's done as much as it would have, I wished he'd done. But he did take some steps. And that was huge, because there had been such a regime of censorship put in place. And you had major universities set up these, quote, misinformation think tanks, these censorship mills, like the Shorenstein Institute over at Harvard, that were examining ways to affect algorithms and how to take out certain thinkers who use certain words. And we're not talking here about, you know, as Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, yelling fire in a crowded theater. You know, of course there has to be community standards. We're talking here about political opinion, about dissent. Anyway.
Yeah, I think you see precursors to that during this period.
Indeed.
Definitely.
Well, I mean, look, I think that it's interesting that FDR wanted to control what people thought and how they thought it, you know, which is what this is. I mean, you control the high ground of media and culture. And I think that's something that any, you know, there's a dark tendency for anyone who is in power to want to do that. The only question is, the issue is how far they've gotten in terms of doing it. I recall in the late 70s, the Church Committee hearings, it was revealed, according to testimony, that the CIA had what was called Operation Mockingbird, where they were literally paying journalists cash in suitcases and other benefits to put out certain stories and certain narratives that they wanted put out. And I don't think that's something that's ever been ended. I don't think there was any claim that it was ended. It was just exposed.
Yeah, you certainly see favoritism towards certain journalists like Walter Winchell, for example.
There you go.
Very much benefits from his association with the administration. He gets certain scoops. He gets certain great stories. It kind of made him really as a journalist. But what you do see during the 1930s is you see Roosevelt is a master of manipulating radio. We all know this, of course, because like Trump, he was able to go to people directly. In case of Trump, it was Twitter. In the case of Roosevelt, it was his fireside speeches. But again, the networks really were under an obligation to give these full coverage. And you did have certain anti-New Deal voices on the radio, but by 1938, they're all off of network radio anyway. They're all forced off the air because the administration is manipulating, often behind the scenes, its authority to get people off the air, like a guy named, very well-known figure at the time, was named Bo Carter. He was on several days a week on network radio, had been supportive of Roosevelt, and he turned against him during the court packing period of 1937.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He's very popular one day, and the next day he's sort of being gradually marginalized and forced off the air, and he's off the air by 38, and there isn't one left. And Roosevelt does that through a lot of different methods, FCC, network broadcasting code, but also advertisers. One of Carter's advertisers was a woman named Marjorie Merriweather Post, who actually owned Mar-a-Lago one time. Very powerful figure, and mm-hmm. she's a Democratic donor. He says, hey, can't you do something about this? And lo and behold, Carter's off the air.
I mean, I don't know if FDR was doing what I've heard happens now, which is that he sends the IRS after them. Or,
If you were in this time, constantly. He's constantly going to his Secretary of Treasury and others saying, can't we audit this person's taxes? Aren't they due for an audit? And you had to be incredibly careful with your taxes if you were a critic of the administration. And several people were. They were very careful. I had the best lawyers, had the rock solid, situation. Yeah. But they're constantly going after people. And this is very well documented how that is occurring. But again, it's deniability. Roosevelt's saying that to his Secretary of the Treasury. He's saying that privately. He'd never do this publicly, which is a lot different than someone like Trump. Trump will do what he thinks. Roosevelt
Trump will just. Trump has that. He has that kind of Queens, New York personality where he'll take somebody on directly. Whereas with FDR, it was the classic. I mean, I don't want to sound, bad here, but it was like the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant approach, old Boston, where the knife would come out behind the scenes, but you'd never see the hand that held it.
They said you could almost enjoy being attacked by him at the beginning, and then then you knew what was happening. You know, the famous "My Little Dog Fallas" speech. I mean, it's brilliant.
But that he sends
no
up that way, sounds like
there, but it's devastating. It's absolutely devastating.
Yeah, I mean, wait, he sent like an Air Force plane to pick up his dog in Alaska or something.
Yeah, yeah, and he turns it around instantly, by joke, right?
Well, he had this great personality, and he had this enormously charismatic image, and this handsome head. It would be intoning this with this tone. I mean, a lot of people, and I think they still do, they work on certain affectations as part of their public image that gives them a certain, people think, oh, they must know what they're talking about. They must be, they have authority. And FDR, I think, was a master at that.
It was said that he could have thrived as a radio commentator. If he had not been a politician, he would have risen to the top in that field.
That's, oh, for
that's
sure.
True.
Yeah, he was brilliant at public presentation. Anyways, David, your book is available everywhere: Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You've got it's a site at the Independent Institute where you are part of the think tank. Give us some additional sort of wrap-up thoughts on this.
Well, I think if you think you know FDR, even know Civil Liberties record, you can learn a little bit from this book. I learned a lot during research. I didn't know about the Black Committee when I started. Mm. Most people don't. But there's a very interesting case involving an African-American Republican leader in Memphis who was really a major political figure there, and he was quashed by an ally of FDR named Mayor Crump, and through all sorts of methods. So there's a lot in here, not only in Japanese internment, there's a lot on sort of FDR's relationship to African-Americans, sedition cases.
Mm-hmm.
For example,
yes.
The Black press during World War II is basically emasculated by a threat of sedition prosecution. The government probably couldn't have done it because that would have been very unpopular, but that was threatened. And as a result, the Black press became very much sort of mm-hmm. under control.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like a version of what we now call lawfare. You know, you go after the opponent and with phony lawsuits and you tie them up and you try to bankrupt them and intimidate them and use big bully boy tactics. I think I read that Eleanor once approached him and said, asked him to look into the lynching, and he told her to mind her own damn business. So,
But the historians cover for him. They'll say, well, he couldn't pass an anti-lynching bill because he needed his New Deal program. Well, that's problematic, even if you look at it closely, because his own vice president was John Nance Gardner, a very conservative Southerner. And Gardner even went to Roosevelt and said, we really have to do something about this. This is getting out of control, this lynching thing. Mm. And Roosevelt told someone about this, and he said he just laughed uncontrollably. Gardner talking about lynching? He didn't see this as, well, gee, maybe there's such outrage that I can do something and not have any danger to the rest of my program. So there's a jaded kind of cynical aspect to him that I think a lot of people don't really appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very strange personality there. I mean, that would look at it that way. Somebody other than Doris Kearns Goodwin should do a deep dive.
Well, you know, the best movie portrayal of Roosevelt, not well known, but a few years ago there was a picture of Treat Williams where he played J. Edgar Hoover. And it has that guy on MASH, David Ogden Stiers, play Roosevelt.
Oh,
and
good.
He's getting frustrated with Hoover. He said, Mr. Hoover, what you need to understand, because Hoover was against Japanese internment. This was insane. Good. And he said, Mr. Hoover, you need to realize that in Washington, all power flows to the center, and I am the center. And I about fell out of my chair. But that's the only sort of negative depiction I've ever seen of FDR. He's still got very good PR, 80 years later.
Well, he definitely had well-placed friends in high places across the board, including the California governor who was leading the effort to the internment, that being Earl Warren at the time. And, it's an interesting study in making these kinds of alliances. It's kind of what has euphemistically been called the Eastern Seaboard liberal establishment, I suppose, that it's very amoral and they tend to think alike and they tend to have an agenda that's hard to explain.
And there's a weird compartmentalization. FDR's own attorney general was against Japanese internment, Francis Biddle, liberal. And he held him off, by the way. FDR wanted to go after people like Charles Lindbergh during the war. He wanted to go after the publisher of the Chicago Tribune and Biddle.
Right, McCormick.
But Biddle's shows this interesting compartmentalization. He dedicated his book, his autobiography in 1962 to FDR. That same autobiography has devastating commentary about FDR and civil liberties and Japanese Americans. Biddle's clear that he fought this and did not, he thought it was an outrageous thing. He ended up going along with it. But the book is dedicated to FDR. So it's hard to figure out that mentality, that compartment.
Well, why do you think he would do, I mean, was this just one massive social experiment to intern an entire ethnic group? Is it similar to the lockdowns, maybe? I don't know. Not to compare, but, is it like, is that what this is about? I mean, is it like a manipulation of the public?
That's an interesting question. If you look at FDR, he wrote op-eds for in the 1920s. And in these op-eds, he wrote about the Japanese Americans. He said, we don't want to have them intermarrying with us. It's okay that California has denied them property ownership if they're immigrants. We certainly shouldn't have immigration. In the late 30s, he said that if we have a war with Japan, he wrote this privately, that we should intern any Japanese American who had met a Japanese ship, met sailors and so forth, in concentration camp. So it's hard to fathom. I don't think he really needed to do it. He could have given a great speech about the four freedoms and how much Americans care about them.
Right.
But he kept them there till 1944. The end of... He was so worried that in 1944 that it would hurt him in the election. even though all of his advisors just about at that time were urging him to let them go, he kept them there. So there's a kind of cold, I don't know what you'd call it.
Maybe it's just old-fashioned, it's old-fashioned racism and bigotry. You know, maybe he, I mean, I know that he was, I believe he made a comment when, before Pearl Harbor, that he goes, the Japanese are not, they're not a threat. Japanese Air Force isn't a threat because the Japanese pilots don't, they don't have good vision. They can't see well based upon,
here's another story he tells. Yeah. Laughed about this one. He said, well, there's an ancient legend that, the Japanese islands, were first inhabited by baboons. And then, I guess he said some prostitutes came there and nature took its course. And he thought this was
funny. I get it,
funny.
Yeah.
You know, he would say things like this.
Right, right. And then, of course, why didn't he intern the Italians? He goes, no, because they're just a bunch of opera singers. So I guess that it's, he had a lot of stereotypical views.
Well, very powerful of figures people. Were Italian. In the Democratic Party.
Well, that's true. Well, that's, that's obviously part. I mean,
you can't put Frank Sinatra behind bars.
Yeah, I mean, how could you do that? You'd have to intern half of the city of New York anyway. But, this is, very interesting insights here in terms of the past is prologue, as it were. And you look at stuff that happened at that time and you can make a definite link to what we're dealing with now. In terms of the infringement upon individual freedoms and individual rights. I hope that people can wake up to that. I really do.
That was a motivator to write the book. And again, like I said, there were some real heroic characters here who fought back.
And yes.
I would hope people could learn some lessons from how they did it. Building coalitions, for example, for civil liberties.
Indeed. All right, David DiBiase, I want to thank you for joining me today. The book is The New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights, The Untold Story of FDR's Concentration Camps, Censorship, and Mass Surveillance. Thanks a lot, David. Let's stay in touch. And I really appreciate it. Great conversation.
Love to come back. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right.
Bye.